when all you have is a search engine, everything looks like a database.
Man, I have like a cypherpunk hard on right now.
Privacy is nothing to be granted. Privacy is something you take yourself.
They've got the Mossad, the CIA, and Hillary Clinton behind them.
We're now beyond what the Stasi could even dream of.
Reality Exploit Roundtable.
Okay, welcome back to Reality Exploit Roundtable. This is episode 17, February 8th, 2013. Today, I'm Hero, your moderator, and we have Voodoo with us today.
Hey, yep.
Hello, Wise Guy.
Howdy.
And Smuggler.
Good day.
And Plato.
Hey, Hero.
All right, welcome to the show, guys. Today, let's set it off with topic number one with Smuggler. Routing security battles intensify. Out there on the net, most of us are familiar with some of the new proposals for DNSSEC, which is Domain Name Security System for adding security and signatures and stuff. It's another centralized system to help domain name spoofing. There's another system out there called BGP, which is a routing protocol, and they're trying to do something similar to this. And there was a quote at the end of this article. It says, if authoritarian governments were smarter and really did want to assert direct control over internet operations, they'd forget about the ITRs that has to do with the internet traffic control and stuff, and push for passage and implementation of BGPSEC, and then make plans to assert legal control over the ROA certificates. These are the certificates just like the DNSSEC for certifying your different changes inside your routing protocol. Oddly, it says the only governments that seem to be present at the ITEF Secure Interdomain Routing Working Group is the U.S. government. So, Smuggler, can you give us a 15-second, a couple of sentence explanation on what BGP, what this routing protocol is, and how it exactly works, and then we can then understand a little bit here about what they're trying to do here with these security and centralized certificate handling?
Sure. BGP is used by internet service providers to connect to each other. It, essentially, you have a router, a computer that is connected via wires to other computers by other parties. And those computers talk to each other and say, hey, I have these IP addresses that I can see with that cost. And what are your IP addresses that you can see? And out of those questions and answers, we call them announcements, routing announcements, the routing tables are generated. And the routing tables essentially say, okay, if a package comes in with a certain destination IP address, like Google or whatever, then take this package and put it on that wire and send it along to the next router. So that is essentially what routing is, and BGP is a way to construct a table of where to send what data or to what addresses are reachable via what cables, to construct that table, the routing table, in a more or less distributed manner. And it's essentially one of the base protocols of the internet. Every internet service provider more or less has to run a BGP router to be able to tell the world what IP addresses he has himself and what other internet service providers he's connected to, because the internet is really a network of many networks. So that is what BGP is for.
Okay, so then in this, what these guys are trying to do is they're trying to say, their base argument is right now these things can be spoofed, and there's, I don't know what their arguments are for actual getting control over this, but they want to implement a system not where individuals are signing that on your BGP sec. You're not just signing your own stuff with your own keys and then everyone knows that your things that you announced are coming from you. They want to do more of a centralized sort of like an SSL certificate type thing. And this would be centralized so that these guys would be able to take your routing, take your certificate, revoke it, and issue their own with new routing information. And then basically your routing broadcast would be completely ignored. Is that correct?
Well, the base motivation, or at least the official motivation, is this. There have been attacks against BGP, attacks that redirected traffic and essentially tunneled that traffic through a man in the middle. Those are BGP redirect attacks. And we had several of them in the past, either by accident or targeted. So for example, maybe 2 years ago, quite a lot of international traffic from the US was actually routed through China, because someone in China made the wrong announcement there, the wrong BGP announcement. And we had the same thing with stuff like YouTube, for example, where Afghanistan was trying to, or Pakistan maybe, was trying to block YouTube, and they did it with BGP, and suddenly half the world couldn't reach YouTube anymore because all YouTube traffic was redirected to an off-the-shelf PC sitting somewhere in the desert. So stuff like that happens and happens again, and something has to be done against that. And that is, so far, I agree with the proposals out there. The real issue, however, is that they are doing one more thing, and that is internet addresses, domains, IP addresses, and so forth are actually resources on the internet that are unique. And you have to make sure that only one person is really using them. And for that, we have a hierarchical structure within the organization of the internet that essentially hands out those resources and says, okay, this party may use those IP addresses and that other party may use those IP addresses. And because those things have to be unique on the network, someone, they say, has to organize that. And all of that is more or less done at the root by some organizations that are organized and sitting in the US. And the problem really is that with the new proposals, both for DNSSEC and for BGPSEC, they want to make sure that not someone is taking over those unique addresses, which are really properties, take them over and abuse them, instead of finding a way how to organize that in a distributed manner. They're trying to make all protocols adhere to a legal hierarchy that is not really part of the internet core itself.
So in other words, they're co-opting it.
It has been co-opted in the past. I mean, from the beginning, the internet was built like that. But now they're trying to cement it through the protocols.
Right. Okay. Can you give a quick recommendation that you would give these people who are trying to solve some of the problems, but not going with this solution? What would be the other solution? It would be a decentralized system of property ownership, correct?
Yes, and I think that is possible. I mean, we have to find out ways how to create those unique properties in a distributed manner that is secure. And there are proposals for that. I mean, there are networks that work with unique properties without having centralized control. A good example for that is I2P or Tor, where your address on the Tor network or the I2P network is something you yourself generate. And you can prove that it's yours without any central control required. Now, those methods cannot be transferred to the internet like they are, but they give us a hint. There's another example of that, and that is Bitcoin. Bitcoin creates unique properties by a distributed challenge. And whoever finds it first gets that property. And something like that should really be done on the internet. And that would solve most of these issues, because those issues really mean that in the future, the internet will not just be legally structured in a hierarchical way, but also on the protocol level. And after that, whoever has access to the keys can really fuck us up.
Now, what about CGS? CJDNS does something, solves a similar problem to this, where you're coming from both sides, and that is, one, having a unique address, like you talked about with Tor, with the Onion and I2P, but the CJDNS also does, it has a tie-in with IPv6 addresses also. So you actually generate an IPv6 address that's tied with a key, and since there's so much address space there, it's easy for anyone just to grab any address. and it does something similar to this.
Well, the difference is that in CGDNS, you actually know that you're only taking over very few resource blocks and that they're equally distributed. On the internet, that is kind of hard to say because the blocks we have to manage are much larger. Especially on a BGP machine, you don't have to deal with one IP address, but usually you deal with hundreds or even thousands of blocks. And you want to keep the management down as much as possible, so you want to have successive IP addresses. So there are ways to do that. I'm not saying that it's impossible. I'm just saying that there are lots of systems out there that tell us that it's possible, but nobody really cares when it comes to the internet.
You know, one thing that this reminds me of a little bit is at the same time that you hear people screaming about the U.S., you know, trying to take control over this right now, if you actually did implement a system where these addresses became somewhat like private property, where you actually received this as a piece of property and you had the key and you could transfer the IP address as ownership to other people. And it was literally like a Bitcoin, like a digital piece of property that could be transferred. The first thing that you would hear people screaming about is that this would be called privatization of the internet. And it would be looked at in the same way that you have privatization in some of these countries where you take a public asset and then and you try to come up with some type of plan in order to how are we going to split this up and distribute it, because once it's gone, it's in these people's hands and let it run. So it's interesting.
Well, I understand how these standards making bodies, you know, work. It's you know, the whole democratization and everybody gets a say and everything. But it really goes back to, you know, hey, you need to take control of the space that you're in charge of and not worry about, you know, I hate to say get away from the standards, but sometimes you need to go away from the standards because the crowd may not know the best way to take care of your property, you know, your IP address. The crowd may not have the best idea about that. And the individual person or organization or corporation that owns that IP space, they need to take good care of it.
Yeah. And this also brings up another point here where you said get away from the standards, but any type of standard which is going to be tied down to some type of particular body and political organization or legal jurisdictional like problems, sometimes it needs a meta protocol. And that's what's interesting about the Onion addresses and the I2P addresses is that when they announce themselves, you announce who you are and what you are and where you're at, but it's not tied to particular IP addresses. So it's sort of a meta protocol where the government can go ahead and take all the IP addresses and control them in all different ways that they want, but it doesn't really matter to you that much because you ride on top of that in sort of a meta network. So that probably will be the bigger thing. I don't know how this sort of like ties in with the a lot of concerns that people have with the old internet system and the new, you know, dark nets. And how can this be used to stop darknets and private address space like the Onion address space? Not to drag this topic on too long, but I think that's an interesting question to ask. Smuggler?
Well, I think the best answer would be design the official incarnation of the routing technology to be just as good as the darknets. I mean, it's unlikely, but...
Well, in my opinion, it's this whole thing is actually a big opportunity for darknets. Because I think it teaches people that you have to treat the internet by now as something like a hostile ground you're driving on. And if you want any freedom or security or whatever, go into an overlay, go into a darknet. And what will happen most likely is that in the case of whatever, Cyber 9/11 or I don't know, you know, whatever they come up with, they might say, come on, stop the darknets, because those are an unregulated space and there are exploits that are dealt there and drugs and everything that is, you know, evil. And they might want to use BGPSec and similar things to force internet providers to take down the nodes. However, I think that will not work. Simply because as soon as the darknets are really cared about, people really understand what they're doing there, and I think people are waking up to that, especially the darknet providers. They see the scope of what they're really trying to do. I think they'll wake up and sooner or later decide to build real good systems that are really hard to take down. Darknet providers and people writing darknet software might actually wake up to things, to the whole scope of their mission, and build darknet protocols that are hard to take down, that don't rely on globally known nodes. So that is the opportunity, so to speak, I think.
That's great. Great answer. And that was exactly the...
Well, that's...
Go ahead, Buddha.
Well, that's the opportunity you said. But in the restatement there, Smuggler, you actually changed it. You were talking about I don't know what you'd call non-darknet, but you were talking about them making resilient networks like more like the darknets that couldn't be taken down. And that makes more sense to me, but I understand why they wouldn't want to do that, because the whole democratization and, you know, Iran and Pakistan and whoever, and the U.S. and China and whoever may be mal actors on the internet have just as much say as you or I do.
Well, I'm sorry. I think I miscommunicated or you misunderstood. What I'm saying is this. I think that the ClearNet powers that are, by implementing those protocols, are essentially contributing to people to wake up and use darknets. That's step number one. Step number two is, sooner or later, the ClearNet operators and powers to be will want to battle the darknets, and they will use any pretense they can come up with. I mean, Cyber 9/11, Silk Road, whatever. I mean, I don't know. But with the growing use of darknets, I think that many darknet operators and coders are beginning to understand that they have to build systems that treat the whole internet and not just some rogue state as hostile territory, and thus build darknets that don't rely on globally known nodes to operate, and thus making them resilient against takedowns that could be facilitated by things like BGPSec.
Okay. Well, even if I misunderstood you, I think the my understanding was even better, that the people in the ClearNet should be working towards that. Because,
yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, we should be working toward a resilient network, not a fragile network. And from what I saw looking at this BGP, it's you know, the more you implement it, and especially with the certificates, the more fragile it gets, and that's just a recipe for disaster.
Did you guys see last week some poor sap misread some legal memo and published a article that got really wide attention, saying the government's planning on bringing free internet to all these cities with big Wi-Fi meshes? And it sounded really, really good idea. I mean, it would be a very smart idea to implement municipal Wi-Fi and, you know, spread the costs out. But it was just kind of funny to see how much attention that got when it was not a plan at all. It was just some possibility mentioned in a memo somewhere.
Right. I mean, the thing is, and there's an awesome article by Bruce Schneier currently,
yes,
that is power and the internet. What people really have to wake up is that the internet is actually not what they think it is. Currently, people think the internet is strong, it's resilient, it's distributed, and all those things. And the only people that have control over it are the people on the ground, so to speak. And that's bullshit. Voodoo, you mentioned something, and that is that implementing stuff like BGPSec is making the internet brittle. And yes, it makes the internet even more brittle than it is. The only reason the internet runs today is because there are thousands of network operators working 24/7 fixing one disaster after the other. That's the reason the internet works. It's those people. And people have to wake up that whatever we do to the internet is a thing built by people, and whoever those people are loyal to defines the future of the internet.
That's great. Great, guys. Let's move on to topic two, and it's very closely related to where we've gone with topic number one, how Facebook briefly hijacked the internet. So I guess over the past few days, this incident happened where people were surfing the internet and visiting regular websites, and they were getting hijacked and thrown over to one of Facebook's, some error page on Facebook's page. And again, these people, they weren't clicking on links in Facebook. They were literally surfing some of the largest websites out there. And this happened for around 10 minutes. And of course, you know, probably thousands or tens of thousands, I don't know how many people are using this tied in with Facebook with their websites for authentication or whatever. But these people got redirected into Facebook. So this happened through some type of JavaScript redirect bug. I'm not sure how the stuff got injected in there, but it was very scary to see how how a little bug caused them to be thrown over into Facebook's page from all of these websites. Plato, what kind of insight do you have on this, since you were liking this particular article?
Well, first, I haven't found a really good postmortem yet explaining what was wrong with Facebook's code to redirect people. And the other thing that I'm not certain about, Facebook, there was a bug that redirected people logging in with Facebook from third-party sites. Mashable says a user didn't even need to be performing an action for the error and hijacking to occur. Instead, simply being logged in to both places and having the accounts linked was enough to force users onto Facebook's error page. So it's unclear at, you know, whether they had to click log in with Facebook and that's when it screwed it up, or if they were already logged in, it would mess up. Either way, what's happening here is that all these sites are pasting code on their pages that's from Facebook, and it may be loading asynchronously even more code from Facebook, and you don't know what that code is. And whether it was asynchronous or not, Facebook ended up, you know, having this redirect problem. And I wish I could tell you exactly what happened, but I'm not sure. Either way, I guess it's just a caution to, like, be aware of what code you're allowed to run on the pages you control.
Yeah, exactly. This goes to show that when you have a lot of people do this, like Google Analytics, and I've seen this, I mentioned it in some other podcasts before, but there's several in the past, there have been several major Bitcoin financial websites that were actually dealing in Bitcoin transactions, which would be loading Google Analytics while you were logged in doing your business, which means that you're logged into a financial Bitcoin financial website, you're doing trades, you're doing exchanges, you're sending and receiving Bitcoins and whatever inside the system. And every time you make this click and everything, you have this code, this JavaScript that is running to track like what people are doing in terms of what pages they're hitting. It's not necessarily a malicious code, just like with this Facebook thing. People didn't have wasn't malicious code, but it was JavaScript that was being loaded from the Google web servers. And in this case, JavaScript being loaded from the Facebook servers. So essentially, when you include any of this code in your system, you are running code on your website from another web service. And all it takes is for someone maliciously, as either man in the middle maliciously to the other website, or someone that hacks into the foreign website, they can put code in there. They can change the code. Like Google could inject something in there or have a bug or have an exploit that instantaneously, all the websites in the world that people are doing stuff that are privately logged in with, their cookies and stuff get sent out to some hacker because they were JavaScript, the JavaScript code executed in the browser and sent out these people's credentials. So that's what you're doing. You're executing code on another person from another person's machine.
Yeah, the scary thing is that with these async calls, the little snippet that you put on your page, it just sends a request out to, you know, its mothership, and whatever the hell the mothership wants to return is what you get. And they could easily put in different code for one IP versus another, or, you know, every 100,000 requests you throw in your little keylogger or whatever, So you just don't know.
Well, I don't think you can consider any code from Facebook as non-malicious. I think every piece of code that you get off of Facebook that reports back to the mothership is malicious code. And I'll stand by that. You know, we can argue that all day long. But for God's sake, can we get the Namecoin authentication going? You know, we need to get rid of this Facebook authentication and Google authentication and OAuth authentication. We need to be doing it over the Namecoin chain where it's public and we can control it ourselves.
Well, actually, I think there are several things that come together here that should be, taken apart and looked at separately. I mean, number one, we have a whole privacy issue. The issue of included JavaScript code or included resource code in a website is a big privacy issue, because Facebook, when you go to a website that loads stuff from Facebook, Facebook knows that you're on that website. Same with Google, and the same with every fucking CDN system out there, CDN, its content delivery network, like Akamai or whatever. So essentially, what you are doing when you have a website and you load foreign JavaScript into it, is you are broadcasting who your visitors are to those people. And personally, I don't trust them shit. So that's number one. Number two is there's a security issue. And as Plato and Voodoo and Hero already said, that could be anything that is sent there, targeted, non-targeted, whatsoever. So I think that it's just deeply negligent that you run a website and you throw something at your customers, at your visitors, that you don't control. I mean, that is horrific. It's not good practice. It's laziness at best. Or you have no idea what you're doing, and then you should stop working in that business. And number three is I think that taking so much trust and outsourcing all the authentication to a few big providers like Google and Facebook is a real danger for the future of communication on the internet, because those big parties will sooner or later become the official identity providers and be able to connect everything you did over the last 30 years on the internet to your ID and use that to data mine you into oblivion. So I think that not even stuff like the Namecoin authentication system is really a solution. Please, I mean, there were times where I had a login into every web page, and this is something a browser can do, and you don't have to outsource that to any other system that's not running on your own.
Does NoScript and similar add-ons, like for Firefox, are they effective at preventing this if they're used adequately by the user?
Yes.
Yeah, another one that's really nice.
Well,
is
what about
Ghostery?
Hang on a second though. If a website has an iframe in it, that's not reporting the browser data to the source of the iframe?
NoScript can catch even that.
Oh, okay.
It's called CrossScript, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay, but here, Smuggler, let me run one thing past you here. As far as the Namecoin chain, you know, I mean, there's the axiom: don't roll your own crypto, right? And for good reason, because the major crypto algorithms are tested constantly tested, retested every day. Shouldn't we be doing the same thing with authentication? And if we can do that through the Namecoin chain and test it and retest it every day in a myriad of different ways, at least we've got one thing that we're attacking there, because rolling your own authentication certainly hasn't been good for the Bitcoin providers. And you know, we know websites where they're not doing good authentication.
Well, the thing is that no matter how you do it, if the website has a bug, then it doesn't matter if you're using Namecoin or Facebook as the backend for your authentication. That's number one. Number two is there's another axiom, and that is don't centralize what you don't have to centralize. And Namecoin is a centralization, not in the sense that it's only running on one computer, but it's just one system. And if that system breaks down, like Facebook, everybody is screwed. So in my opinion, there are lots and lots of good authentication and authorization methods out there that could be simply included in the browser. There are good protocols for that. And why not just do that? You know, then the credentials are exchanged exactly between those two parties that need to have them. And that is the provider of the service and the user, nobody else. And that is what how it should be.
You're talking like the browser certificate with the specific website, client-side certificate?
Yeah, for example. But you can do that with any kind of crypto scheme there. I mean, it doesn't have to be a certificate. It could be something very simple, like a password manager that doesn't ask you to create a password, but just creates a password and sends it. I mean, there's no reason for user interaction to put in a password for every single fucking website.
Yeah. Well, we're getting into another topic here, and this would be a good topic for another show, and even a whole dedicated show, actually. So good stuff. Oh, real quick, I did know, just to bring up the thing about the a centralized identification system being used as an official ID. I saw this past week somewhere, I think it was in the UK, that the UK government now is accepting accounts for some type of like welfare benefits or something. And your identification can be verified and sign up through your PayPal. And PayPal is being registered as an official government identity provider for this particular program. You guys hear about this?
Yeah, and in my opinion, the basic strategy behind both Google, Facebook, and whatsoever big website is out there is to sooner or later become the ID system for the whole world.
Wow.
Oh, hell yeah. If you could know what every user logged into, wouldn't you want to? Of course they are.
Yeah, it's totally logical. Well, yeah. It's also very, very scary.
Well, it's the same thing in the real world, in meat space. You have a particular program that gets put up, and then what happens is then the government mandates it, and then everyone's required to be part of that service. So if you were, if every living American was required to have a particular ID with a particular company, that company would be guaranteed by law and by guns 300 million or whatever it is in the U.S. People as integrated into the service. Yeah, something else. Anyway, let's move on here. Voodoo, this is another topic. It's kind of interesting how some of these topics tend to like roll in together. The EU wants power to sack journalists. Quote from one of the articles we have linked to in the show notes. A European Union report has urged tight press regulation and demanded that Brussels officials are given control of national media supervisors with new powers to enforce fines or the sacking of journalists. The National Media Council should follow us. This is what they said: should follow a set of European-wide standards and be monitored by the Commission to ensure they comply with European values. The report said. I find that last word in that statement actually to be some of the scarier part of this whole thing. How they're actually using the word values rather than, you know, European law or some type of thing like that. Anyway, so Great Britain, the UK. They're up in arms about this and many other people. I find it interesting because you have one other part I didn't mention in here is they talked about possibly revoking journalist status. And in the U.S., this has been sort of an interesting thing that's happened over the past few years with a blogger or someone who has a news website saying or doing something. And then when they go to court, they, you know, claim this... one of these First Amendment freedom of speech and freedom of the press or freedom of the press. And there's certain laws in the United States which give journalistic institutions or individuals who are official journalists have certain types of protections that some other individuals don't have by saying the same thing on a blog. So there's been talk in the past about actually licensing in order to distinguish between who has those protections and the not. So, Voodoo, what is your take on this?
Well, I think it's hilarious to act like, you know, the press aren't the lapdog media in the first place. But you're right. There is a significant difference between European countries and the United States in that we do have a First Amendment. And if, you know, I'm obviously the amendments to the Constitution of the U.S. do not grant these rights. Freedom of the press is something that's there, and it, we all have it. But even in the, you know, it, you can point to contra examples, but in the United States, anybody who wants to crank up a printing press or a blog or whatever has protections under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And, you know, whereas in other parts of the world, obviously that's not true. But here's the deal, that in order to get access to the news, which all news seems to revolve around some political thing, which is, you know, the sickening part, you can't even watch the news if you're an apolitical person. You have to kowtow to them, and you ask the question, and then you maybe get what you do the follow up, but you don't do the hard hitting journalism. You don't ever contradict a politician on what they say or anything, because then you will never have access to them. In this case, what it is it's a group of people that want, even though that's happening, they want it, the news to go their way, and specifically in the way of the European Union. And, you know, the EU is this behemoth that's taken over the Europeans, and you know, there may be somebody speaking against it, and they just cannot handle anybody talking out against the European Union. And I think this will probably be, well, you know, this will be incorporated, and this will be something that European quote unquote journalists will have to deal with.
Yeah, it seems
Go ahead,
Smuggler.
Let me throw in something here. First Amendment, please. I mean, you Americans and your Constitution. Nobody gives a fuck about the Constitution and government anymore, you know? And it's the same thing over in the European countries. Yes, every single country here has something like a constitution. And in my, as far as I know, every one of them has something like the First Amendment. But as long as government is allowed to interpret the constitution, it will be abused and not cared about. You know, it's just lip service. Sooner or later, the reading of the constitution changes, and that's it. And that is what we're experiencing in the US and in Europe and everywhere else. You know, I mean, governments are not bound by pieces of paper. That doesn't regulate them. You know, pieces of paper are what you point to for the slaves to shut up. So in my opinion, what is really happening here is something you Americans will see very soon as well, if you're not already seeing that. And when we're talking about the accreditation of journalists, what the people here are really saying is that only those journalists that are nicely reporting according to the values of the European Union are allowed to join press conferences of the European Union. That is what's about. It's not about having a certain ID card that says you're a press, but it's about you are only invited into the press conferences if you come with the right recommendation, if you have shown that you are a good PR person.
No, I agree 100% with you, Smuggler. It's I wasn't trying to say something different. What I am saying is that the U.S. Constitution is the oldest document, as far as I know, as far as the community of, I shouldn't say document, I should say, you know, with the constitutions, because half of them aren't written, they're just called constitutions, that codifies the fact that there is freedom of the press, and it doesn't delineate. It doesn't say if you are an accredited journalist. And in the United States, I guarantee you that right will be defended as well, probably more so than the Second Amendment, you know, the right to bear and keep and bear arms. In the United States, people just won't shut up.
I'd suggest to you that you learn a little bit more about European history and how many other old constitutions are out there.
Well, I think what's happening is, as we all know, that media has been the lapdog, even from the days of newspapers, for whatever government was in power, and for the same reasons that we've been talking about here, that if if you're not a good, let's say, team player with whoever is in power, and you know what the social discourse is supposed to be, what's supposed to be permitted in the media, then you're not invited to any of the meetings, and you're basically shut out of access to government. However, that being said, the more that happens, the more the media becomes alienated, and the fewer people, especially younger people, who get their news from the internet will even seek to listen to what the major media are reporting. They'll become superfluous. You know, one of the things about the U.S. is that in the Declaration of Independence, it clearly sets forth that the government gets its powers from the consent of the governed. And I think what's likely to happen more and more is as the government and the media team up to become just one big propaganda machine, people will decide every way they can, every way that they're not frightened to, of removing their consent from being governed.
Yeah, I'll throw a little tidbit here from on the old distributed city forums. There was a member named MacMac who was from Russia. As a kid, he used to tell the stories how that they would get all excited during school when they get the day off of school, because to go into the town to wave Soviet Union flags as Khrushchev was parading through town. But anyway, one thing he said about the difference between the Russian and the USSR media and the American media, he said, was that over there during the time, sure, it was all full of propaganda and everything. He says, but everyone knew that. Everyone knew it was propaganda, so it didn't have the same weight and effect on to people as in the United States and many countries around with the main streams of media, that where people tend to just go ahead and think, oh, we have a free press and it's all vetted and it's all investigated and it's free, so therefore you believe everything that comes down. So your points are the stuff that you just said, wise guy, like really hits home, and I think that it's happening right now with a lot of people.
Absolutely, Hero, and that was my broader point, was that let's not pretend that it's not a lapdog media. You know, and Pravda is a great example. You know, hey, it was in Pravda. Oh, great. You know, even today, something's in Pravda. Okay, fine. You know, something's on RT. It's Russian media. Something's on CBS. Okay, that's American media. Something's on, you know, whatever channel it is. We can't pretend as if a major media, a corporate media, or a state-sponsored media is going to be anything other than lapdog. And so this is just this going back to the story. This is the European Union trying to say, no, we need having stuff spun Ireland's way or having stuff spun England's way is not good enough. We need it to be spun the EU way. And we're not going to rest until that's done.
Yeah, you're right, Uday. I mean, that is exactly what they're trying to do. However, I think that media in itself, no matter where it comes from, is always spun, be it mainstream or not mainstream. People believe that there's something like objective reporting, and I don't think that it's ever true. I mean, even a blog can't be really objective. I've been part of a media project which really tried to not be any subjective value in there, not to have any political affiliation in there. It's damn hard. And that never happens. And I think that
the damn hard, I'd call it impossible.
Right. Yes. And that is why I think that the real change that is necessary is that people don't judge based on only the media, but that they you know, sit back, think about their own lives, what they really get firsthand, what they're witnesses of firsthand, and make their decisions based on the reality they experience and not the simulation out of media.
I think that in the last presidential election, it was very obvious on how biased, unconsciously, which I think is the most significant and important aspect of media, and that is not about the questions that were asked, but the questions that were not asked. And this is often more telling about the mindset of the reporters and how they've unconsciously absorbed. For instance, if you serve in Washington, D.C., attend the parties, and et cetera, that eventually the mindset of D.C. is imbued in you, in the sense of you understand what things are okay to talk about and what things are not to be mentioned in a public forum. And so when you saw that many of the questions that were thrown at the candidates were softballs and there was no hardball going on, like it would be, for instance, if one of the comedy channel people who do news type of programs were actually lobbing the balls at them, you never see that from any of the major media.
And no, I can understand that, because Obama might send a drone after you if you're not nice.
There's a news I think it's an HBO or a Showtime series called The Newsroom, written by Alan Sorkin. Now, whether you like it or you don't like it or you think it's really biased, it's the first program that I've seen since, I guess, Network, back in 1976, in which it attempts to explain how media really works today and what challenges it faces and who the people are behind the camera.
Good stuff, guys. Let's move along here to the next topic. This next topic is pretty fascinating and a little crazy. We're going to have Wise Guy cover it. The U.S. government, U.S. Army has developed some type of lightning laser weapon. And when you look at this thing and you read about it, the first thing that I thought of was, this looks like some type of like a Star Trek phaser or Star Wars laser type energy beam. But it's not. It's a little different than thinking of like a lot of these energy beams or laser beam weapons that they've tried to develop in the past. A lot of them were focused on like sending just a very high powered laser into something, and it has all this energy in it and it burns it or whatever. But this is different because it appears that they're using the laser to actually direct some other type of energy beam, so it works like a lightning bolt, a lightning bolt from the sky that is able to be actually directed because it follows the laser or something. Wise Guy, can you give us, not getting too technical on it, but a real quick rundown on how this particularly works and what's so scary about this?
Right. Well, the systems in that article they're talking about are called electrolasers, and I provided a link on the RER episode that we're in, so people listening can look it up. And basically the way it works is that if you have the right frequency and intensity of a laser pulse, usually it's pulsed, not continuous, it will create a conductive channel in the air as it travels along by stripping off the electrons from the atoms in the air, mostly nitrogen, some oxygen. Those are the two major constituents in the air. It strips off the electrons, and the atoms that are in the beam and alongside it become conductive. They become ionized. And the laser pulse is used to create this channel to the target that you're trying to damage or destroy. And a short time after the channel is created, it might only persist for a few milliseconds, a huge pulse of electrostatic energy is sent up that channel and using it essentially as an invisible wire to the target and to deliver a fatal shock to the electronics, mostly, of the system. Now, those systems only work if you can efficiently propagate and couple it to the target. In the past, most aircraft, drones, etc., might have been made from metal, but today everything is made of composites. That makes it much more difficult to deliver these kinds of electrical shocks. Now, there certainly will be antennas and things on the drones, but in many cases, for good reasons, those antennas all point upward towards space now in order to be controlled by satellites, steered, etc., with nothing conductive facing downward. It's going to be interesting to see whether or not these systems can actually work against drones that have been specially hardened against these kinds of other technologies. Now, that being said, in addition to using these electrolaser systems, you also have just straight lasers in which a very intense laser beam, not pulsed necessarily, will be used to destroy the target. Recently, in a BBC News article, Rheinmetall, which is a German company, demonstrated a laser that they say can shoot down these drones. I've provided another link to that one as well. Now, Those systems have been around since at least the mid-1980s, where the United States Navy had a project called Magic Lantern. They used a chemically fueled rocket, essentially, which combined deuterium and fluorine, which they were able to laze across the exhaust nozzle and create an incredibly intense beam. Not only in these Rheinmetall things, they're talking about 50 or 150 kilowatts. Well, the systems from Magic Lantern were megawatt continuous energies, and they successfully shot down large targets. I mean, you know, airliner-sized targets at great distances. But those systems were abandoned because they were chemically based, and you have to figure out how you're not going to kill everyone in the area with the deuterium fluoride gas that comes out of them. One more thing, these systems that are essentially creating like a lightning bolt to the target, they actually have come out of other testing in which people were able to cause real lightning bolts in the proper atmospheric conditions to be discharged in a controlled manner at a time and place of your choosing, whenever there was a left electrostatic energy differential between the sky or the clouds and the ground. And those have been used for research mainly. However, there's also an opportunity to use them to pump electromagnetic pulse weapons, which are more often explosively pumped. It could be quite possible that you could use a lightning discharge and what's called a Q-switch to reduce the pulse to a very small time frame, much smaller than a lightning discharge, down to, you know, microseconds or nanoseconds, and direct that into devices that are used to create electromagnetic pulses. Those could be localized weapons that could wipe out large areas of electronic communications and technology around the system that was targeting this. And lasers can now be used, as you can see, to create these conductive channels to the clouds.
Okay, real quick, hold on. We covered a lot of interesting stuff there. On this last one, you're talking about, did you like describe something in essence that is like a laser that would work like a lightning rod to capture the lightning energy and then redistribute that as a weapon?
Exactly. The United States and and the Soviet Union especially, and probably the Chinese now, have all researched what are called electromagnetic pulse weapons. These weapons are directed against electronics and communications infrastructure. The purpose is to provide such an intense pulse of electromagnetic energy that it couples to the circuits in communications or computing equipment and burns them out. And they've been effectively tested. The genesis for electromagnetic pulse weapons actually came from atomic and nuclear testing, because it turns out that if you discharge a nuclear weapon high in the atmosphere, instead of trying to do a ground strike against the enemy, what it does is it creates an enormous electromagnetic storm in the atmosphere, and the energy from the weapon discharge can be converted efficiently into an electromagnetic pulse, and it can blanket thousands of square miles with an electromagnetic pulse intensity that will destroy almost any electronics that haven't been especially hardened.
Okay, but that the only other weapon that they have been that has been known to do something like that is a nuclear weapon, correct? Creating an EMP.
Saying that there's actually a hand grenade-sized EMP device that is now used by the Israelis, and there have been non-nuclear EMP missiles for at least 5 years now.
What kind of range are we talking about? Like, for the hand grenade EMP, how many like square meters would that affect?
I'm not totally sure, but it's mostly used inside houses against the same room.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. Right. The ones that are the weapons that are larger, that are dropped from aircraft or they're part of a missile, what they typically have is they have a warhead, an explosive warhead, and this explosive warhead it's wrapped around a coil of wire that's been charged up with a battery from the missile, and as it approaches the target, the coil is charged up, and when it's time to detonate the electromagnetic weapon, the explosive detonates, and what it does is it squeezes this coil which has the energy in it and is stored it as a coil would, like in a car ignition system. But it squeezes it in a very controlled fashion from one end to the other, like a toothpaste tube. And while it's essentially shorting out the coil, the energy from the explosive is being amplified by the electricity in the coil. So by the time the explosion is done, it's converted a substantial amount of the chemical energy of the explosion into an electrical pulse that continues into the rest of the electronics of the missile. Now, this all happens in milliseconds or microseconds, because the missile eventually will be destroyed by this explosion, but not before it releases a gigawatt pulse of electromagnetic energy aimed at the target at specific frequencies.
That's crazy. Let's back up to the beginning here when we're talking about this lightning laser like directed bolt. I mean, how practical and how far are we away from possibly having essentially what this is a stun gun, like you mentioned at the beginning. It's sort of like a stun gun that is directed instead of with a wire, one of these tasers that shoot out with the wires. Instead, it's aimed and it's projected through this light pulse. I mean, are we going to have cops with laser guided stun guns coming up?
They already exist. They actually already exist. It's possible to create a short-range conductive path with an ultraviolet laser. And those have been tested, but I'm not sure if they've actually been fielded. I would not be surprised that soon we will actually see, sort of laser tasers.
So what kind of, how big of a device and what kind of price and what kind of range would it be for someone to basically, with the same type of power and effects that a stun gun, you take a stun gun to somebody's neck, one of these ones that you buy that have the 9-volt batteries or these ones, more powerful ones maybe that the cops have, a device, something to like that, to where someone could aim a laser at you from, a football field away and you're having a seizure on the ground with the getting shocked.
I don't think that they'll be able to have that kind of range with a laser system, because laser light, like any light, diminishes at the distance. So it may not diffuse as quickly because it's a more focused beam in the characteristics. But I doubt it would have a range more than a few times what a wire-type guided taser would have. But the advantage is that it would operate instantaneously. And it might even be more effective at delivering the electrical pulse than shooting the taser wires at someone, which may or may not penetrate clothing.
Well, you should keep in mind that is not the only crazy weapon technology that is developed. I mean, there are other methods to guide shocks. There's stuff used, like, for example, high-speed geode distribution that is used as a conductor, or you can actually shoot the taser itself without the wire from a shotgun. You know, there's shotgun ammunition for electroshockers. I mean, you shoot the electroshocker at somebody. So stuff like that already exists, since it's marketed to law enforcement, actually.
I suppose that there was an article recently about people coming up with protective clothing against drones and things like that, but it would seem much more likely that conductive clothing using metallized fibers would be effective against a lot of these weapons, including even the shotgun weapon, because the conductive path in the clothing would tend to provide a lower impedance path for the energy and short it out.
Yeah, there's underwear that is conductive. I mean, please. I mean, that's available on the internet and you should use it.
Yeah, but that's for a completely different use. What my first thing with this is, as you're explaining it, wise guy, is this would make an awesome spark plug.
Yes, if the combustion chamber was the size of a city.
No, if you can, no, you don't understand. At the speeds they're running, if you can tunnel further into the fuel air mixture, than just the spark plug itself, if you can tunnel out a cylinder in the fuel air mixture, you're going to get better combustion.
Now, well, you know, but the inside of a combustion chamber is a pretty hostile environment, and I'm not sure whether or not these systems would survive and be, and stay effective like a spark plug does over, you know, 50,000 miles of driving.
Well, serial number one is never the one you want to buy, but that, you know, if you can tunnel in, if you can tunnel into the fuel air mixture, and especially, you know, provide a cylinder of spark as opposed to just a point spark up at the top of the fuel air mixture, you're getting a more complete combustion, and you move past top dead center more, move the flame curve out. This sounds like a great technology to me.
No, I prefer diesel if you're going to have reliability like that. You can make diesel systems run off of any kind of vegetable oil. McDonald's is great.
Yeah, but you're dealing with a lot of mechanics with diesels. With gasoline engines, you're dealing with pure spark. You just time the spark. You don't have to deal with all the injection and the mechanics of it.
Well, yeah, but even the gasoline engines today have almost as complex injection systems to meter out and measure the fuel so that you optimize all of the characteristics of the engine operation and fuel economy. I don't think there's a big difference between diesel and gasoline engines today in injection sophistication.
Well, all I'm saying is if you can tunnel into the fuel air mixture, because there's only so much area in the top of a, you know, piston between the head, if you can tunnel into there and provide more spark, you are igniting more of the fuel air mixture at a given time, because the flame curve, you know, it does go out from the spark plug. It's like an umbrella that shoots out from there. If you can do that, that would be awesome for providing
the horsepower. The laser would probably ignite it itself, but I think that's a little bit off topic.
Well, yeah, you know what? It kind of falls into our next segment of the show, which is our picks. And speaking of beer can engines, maybe you might want to think about registering beer can plasma engines, Voodoo.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm digging this. I'm liking it.
Would you like to make a few plugs there, Voodoo? You first.
Yeah, you know, I run blackandyellowpages.com, blackandyellowpages.com. All you have to do is, if you're looking for agorist businesses, go to blackandyellowpages.com, and you'll see agorist businesses in your area. You can search by area or whatever. And if you would like a listing, a free listing on blackandyellowpages.com, just send me an email to voodoo@blackandyellowpages.com, and I'll send you an invite. It'll be free and easy.
All right, Smuggler, how about you?
Well, I could plug anaplex.net, which is currently undergoing renovation, and shadowlife.cc. Anaplex.net deals with mostly writings on crypto-anarchism and crypto-tribes, while shadowlife.cc is all about privacy. If you're using it, please use it through I2P or Tor, because the future is in the darknets.
Yeah, I saw someone in the channel was surprised to hear that Anaplex actually did have a few darknet addresses. So I guess those can be found on the main website, yes? On the .net site?
Absolutely. It's on anaplex.itp, and the other one is shadowlife.itp.
Okay, great. Plato, how about you?
Well, I just renewed therealplato.com. There's nothing there yet, but hopefully by the time you listen to this, I'll throw some stuff up there, maybe just little games, projects, whatever. And you can come look at my code at GitHub or contact me on Reddit. My handle everywhere is The Real Plato.
Well, and Hero, you can catch some of the podcasts that I've done in the past and upcoming podcast on agoristradio.com for now. And check out a lot of interesting news stuff related to Bitcoin, privacy, and other general stuff in the world on orlingrabe.com, orlingrabe.com. And winds up episode 17 of the Reality Exploit Roundtable. Thank you very much, Voodoo, Smuggler, Plato, and Wise Guy. This was another great episode. I enjoyed it a lot. I hope that you, our listeners, also enjoy it and come back and listen to some of our upcoming episodes and catch our past ones that you haven't seen over at agoristradio.com. Thanks, guys.